Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm Natalie Nittam, your host. There's a moment a lot of women hit in their 40s where they look in the mirror and think, who's this? Now, that's exactly what we're unpacking today with Cynthia Thurlow. Why perimenopause can feel like total chaos, but is actually a powerful wake-up call. Now, guys, before you skip this episode, if you want to know what your wife, girlfriend, or even work colleagues are going through, you might just want to stick around. Now, we get into hidden drivers behind weight gain, sleep issues, and brain fog, including how estrogen loss affects your gut, your immune system, and your ability to handle stress. Cynthia also shares why high-achieving women often struggle the most during this phase and why the old push-harder mindset completely backfires. Now, this conversation is equal parts science and reality check, and it might completely change how you think about midlife. Her new book is called The Menopause Gut, and you'll definitely want to check it out. Next, we're just going to thank a couple of the sponsors who make this show possible, and then we're off. What if doing less actually helped your body do more? We're constantly adding things to our routines, more supplements, more workouts, more products, more protocols. But if your body is stuck in stress mode, none of it really lands the way it should. You're wired, tired, and never really quite recovering. Now, one thing I keep coming back to is my infrared sauna. Not as a push harder tool, but as a reset. A few sessions a week, sometimes short, sometimes longer, depending on how I feel, and it helps my body shift gears. Infrared sauna therapy uses light energy, not just heat, to gently warm your body from the inside out. That supports mitochondrial energy, circulation, detoxification pathways, and most importantly, your nervous system. And I use Sunlighten because they've been leading this space for over 25 years. Their full spectrum infrared plus integrated red light makes it a one-stop session. And they have options that actually fit real homes and real budgets. Everything from your full cabin sauna to a solo portable version. So if you're building a smarter longevity routine, this is a foundational piece. Learn more and save up to $1,600 plus get free shipping on your sauna purchase when you visit sunlighten.com and use code NATLONGEVITY. At some point, we've all been sold a bit of a protein lie. Let's say you eat an 8-ounce chicken breast. You're consuming about 50 grams of protein, right? Not so fast. Just because something contains 50 grams of protein doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get to use all 50 grams. The fact is that if protein isn't fully digested, some of it may pass through the digestive system unused. Now, this is because your small intestine can only absorb protein that's been broken down into smaller building blocks called amino acids. So it doesn't matter if you're consuming 50 grams of protein or 500 grams of protein. If your protein digestion is incomplete, your muscles will be starving for those vital building blocks. Now, this is why it's crucial you take a high-quality digestive enzyme. And before you run out and buy a random bottle of enzymes, you need to know exactly what to look for. Many enzyme formulas provide limited protease activity, especially for people consuming higher protein diets. The hefty costs stop most companies from developing and stabilizing proteolytic enzymes. The one that I trust, recommend, use myself, and love is called Masszymes by Bioptimizers. Masszymes is a full-spectrum enzyme formula with four times more protease than most top competitors. Plus, it contains other key enzymes you need to support optimal digestion. And the bonus, you can try it risk-free. Their 365-day full money-back guarantee is the gold standard in the industry. You get to save 15% off at bioptimizers.com/bionat with code BIONAT. Cynthia Thurlow, welcome back to the show. It is an absolute pleasure to have you back here today.
Oh, so good to be here, Nat. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, these are big, important conversations. And I think maybe before we jump into anything else, you know, without launching into major details, like at a high level, this question is coming from me being at an event this week and starting to really think about menopause and perimenopause in a different way, and particularly maybe perimenopause, because that is the most tumultuous transition, if you will, next to puberty in a woman's life. But what is the cost to women of unaddressed perimenopause? And maybe not just to them, but to the people around them.
Such a great question. I think of perimenopause as a litmus test. It's a litmus test of how well you take care of yourself, how well you're in alignment with your values and your choices. I think for a lot of women, perimenopause is the first time in their adult lives that they start to question everything. Because in those declining hormones and changes in neurotransmitters, I think for a lot of women, it is perhaps the first time in their adult lives where they get clarity on what is working well for them and not. And so I think for so many women, their strategies and their patterns of behavior that work well as a teenager, 20 and 30 something, suddenly no longer work quite as well and can become incredibly maladaptive. And I'm really speaking to the women that are very high achieving, have been incredibly successful in any capacity of their lives, where they suddenly look in the mirror and they're like, not only do I not feel like myself, I can't identify with the person I am today. And so I really think about perimenopause as this hormonal chaos period in our lives, very different than puberty. I think puberty, we go into it, we're just kind of stumbling, bumbling forward.
Exactly.
Whereas in perimenopause, we've had, you know, 30 plus years of life to be able to reflect on and say, am I happy with my partner? Am I happy in my job? Am I happy energetically with where I am at this point in my life? And so I think it's an invitation for us as women to really reflect on what is working for us and what isn't. I know for myself personally that as a reformed people pleaser, one of the reasons why I was such a successful nurse practitioner working in predominantly a male-dominated field of cardiology was that I was incredibly accommodating. And I think for so many women, one thing that they find their voices in middle age and they stop looking back. They're just like, I'm only looking forward. And this means that I'm going to be clear about what I like and I don't like. I'm going to get clarity on my relationships. I'm going to get clarity on my choice of occupation. And it's why I think in many instances, women start making some pretty dramatic changes. And when I say that, it doesn't per se mean that women leave their job or they leave their partner or spouse, but they get tremendous clarity about what they want and what they don't want. And that can be empowering and also terrifying. I think for so many women, it's perhaps the first time in their lives that they're doing exactly what they want. And I think that that is, you know, perhaps for those of us in our lives that are used to us maybe playing small and being incredibly accommodating and just doing what we're told, all of a sudden we're questioning our relationships with family members and we're questioning relationships, you know, at work and questioning what we're doing and trying to figure out what serves us and no longer serves us. So I look at this time in a woman's life as a great awakening. It's a great opportunity to course correct and, you know, change the narrative for ourselves. And that's something that I don't per se see a lot of people talking about. You know, we talk a lot about hormone replacement therapy and supplements and peptides and things that are clearly very important, maybe very clear. But all of a sudden it's like, are we really asking women what they want at this time in their lives?
Yeah, I think you, I mean, that's beautifully said. I think the tricky thing is, and maybe this is where, and we'll dovetail into the meat of the episode, but I think this is where maybe it is important to, for women to get access to the care they need at this time so that they can have the clarity, right? If your hormones are all over the map and kind of running the show and maybe running you into the ground because you're not sleeping, because you don't feel like yourself, because you're, you know, you're moody or whatever, all the things that can come with perimenopause when, you know, in a world where too many women are still being told by their doctors, oh, well, you're in perimenopause, you know, strap yourself in and hang on for the ride kind of thing. That's where I think the greatest disservice maybe is being done to women is by not offering them the support, whether it's a supplement, whether it's lifestyle, whether it's bioidentical hormones, whether it's conventional, whatever, without acknowledging and giving them that support, we're now being asked to, we're now in a position of going through this transition where the way you describe it, it can be so incredibly positive moving forward, but it's kind of like asking a drunk person to make a good decision.
Yeah, no, I mean, and let me be clear, I'm 54 years old. I can tell you 12 years ago, I was given four options when I talked to my GYN about my periods being heavy. I was told oral contraceptives, an IUD, an ablation, or I'm done having kids, just take your uterus out.
You don't need it anyway.
And those were the only options I was provided. And I was told, Cynthia, you should just be expected to gain weight from here on out. Like, you're 42 years old. This should be normal. And I just said, I refuse to accept all of that. Like, there has to be a better plan, a better way. And so I fired that GYN and found a wonderful midwife who was much more alignment with where I wanted to be. And so I want any woman that's listening to this conversation to know you do not have to accept care that is not in alignment with your true values. And if anyone listening decided to take the oral contraceptives or the IUD or the ablation or hysterectomy, that's the right choice for you. And that's great. It wasn't for me. And even as a licensed medical provider, those were the options I was given. Now, granted, 12 years ago, we weren't having these kinds of conversations quite as openly. And I think we've made great strides over the last 5 to 10 years. But I think in many instances, there's still women being told, shut up, take the oral contraceptive. You expect your sleep to be bad. So what if you can't feel like you feel like you're losing your mind? We're going to put you on an antidepressant. We're going to treat you with anti-anxiety meds. And you just have to accept things as they are. And I think that that is a really terrible way to reframe middle age and beyond, that you just have to accept things as they are with no alternatives and no other options.
Yeah. Especially when we know that there are alternatives and options. So would that moment be the moment when you really figured out, or you got clarity on how underserved women in midlife were?
Absolutely.
Like, is that kind of when the bulb went off, or was there some other?
No, yeah. I mean, I think not. It was then. And then it was the realization that I was like, okay, well, let's reflect on what little information I received in my medical training about menopause, like next to nothing.
Like none.
There's no mention of perimenopause. So no one prepared me. And I was like, if I'm not prepared, then none of my patients are prepared. And at that time, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, I cannot think of maybe other, I bought Suzanne Summers' book.
Yeah. She was a pioneer in this space, really.
And I bought her books, and I'm trying to think if there was anyone else who had much of anything at that time and just wanted to read voraciously. And so I think on a lot of levels, it brought me to the realization that my lifestyle no longer suited my physiology. And that was a very hard reckoning to have, because I loved everything about being a nurse practitioner, working in cardiology, but the stress of my job, because the NPs in my practice, it was a very large cardiology practice. We did inpatient, outpatient management. We functioned like residents. We were incredibly autonomous. The stress of my job combined with little kids, combined with a husband who traveled, combined with not enough sleep, combined with being hardcore paleo. So I was really low carbohydrate. No longer was an really intense exercise, was no longer in alignment with my physiology. And so I felt incredibly lost in space. Like, where am I going? I don't know who to talk to. You know, I stumbled into a functional medicine practice, thank God. I had a great nurse midwife. Shout out to Courtney that lives in Northern Virginia. And I think that was the beginning, but there were so many other women who felt exactly like I did, which is why when I left traditional allopathic medicine 10 years ago, April 1st will be exactly 10 years. So it's hard to
wrap
around that. Yeah, exactly. That's a big milestone. No one was talking about these things. And I think in many ways, there's been a groundswell of women, like Gen X is just not sitting down or shutting up. We're just speaking up and out. And hoping that this helps younger generations and helps women advocate for themselves, because it is not acceptable. You know, the kind of patriarchal medical system, the way that it is created, and I'm paraphrasing from other guests I've had on my podcast who've said, as medical providers themselves, especially male physicians, no man would put up with what women have put up with.
Yeah.
Full stop. So
yeah.
I think that
absolutely
this generation is speaking up and out so that more women are aware that there are more options than suffer in silence, shut up, accept things as they are, which we're definitely not doing that.
Well, and it's not necessary, right? It's just that's a position born out of ignorance. As you said, physicians are not being trained in school that perimenopause is really anything, or if it is, I don't even think it's mentioned. So you talk about middle pause. Let's define that. What does that really, why did we need another pause? Like, we have a perimenopause, we have a menopause. What's middle pause?
Do you want me to give you my honest answer?
Yeah.
Because I was so tired in writing the book to say perimenopause and menopause that I just decided, I was like, I'm just going to coin this phrase because it defines middle age. And then you throw the word pause in there and it's very descriptive, but it's less of a mouthful. I mean, it is really synopsizing the experiences that women have from mid to late 30s into the menopausal transition and typifies the experiences that we have. It's just not just a physiological shift. It is a psychological shift. It is a spiritual shift. And so middle pause was really born out of my desire to shorten perimenopause and menopause, because I felt like I kept saying that over and over and over again in the book. And so I was like, middle pause, this makes sense. It's short. It's short and sweet. And so that's literally how it came about, just to shorten the phrase. Because I would literally just start writing peri/menopause because I was saying it over and over and over again.
Right.
But, you know, wanting to be concise is really what that was born from. But it still represents the same experience for women.
So a lot of people, and I mean, I'm sure, you know, as far as physicians will go, typically who haven't gotten the training, this is all about your period stopping, right? But what's really happening kind of on a hormonal level, on a metabolic level, even on an immunologic level? Like, what can you help? Let's take the audience through, what does this really mean physically? Like, you've talked about spiritual, emotional, we can get to that, but let's talk, because, you know, as you had said earlier, your doctor said to you, and yeah, guess what? You're going to be packing on some weight, which frankly is more insight than a lot of women get. Most women just wake up one morning, look down and go, where did this all come from?
Yeah. Like,
this is not me, right? That's part of the not recognizing yourself. So can we kind of enlighten women or listeners, because maybe men are listening to this too, to try and understand what the heck is happening with their partners? What's really happening here on a hormonal, metabolic, and immunological level?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We know what really constitutes the beginning of perimenopause is this reduction of progesterone. And for many women, this shows up as trouble sleeping, maybe more anxiety, more mood disorders around their menstrual cycle. But I think at a larger, like, kind of macro level, we're really looking at, as we see these declines in hormones and changes in neurotransmitters, it impacts every single system of the body. It is not just bikini medicine. It is not just about fertility. It is not just about, you know, your breasts drooping or your skin drooping. It really is helping women understand that as estrogen declines in particular, it has catastrophic effects on the body. That's why we see higher rates of bone health issues, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, changes in cognition, changes in body composition. But what's interesting to me is I know more about the immune system now than I ever did before. I don't know if that's good or bad. I had to map things out on a whiteboard because it can get very complicated. But one of the markers of the aging process is something called immunosenescence, which is really speaking to aging of the immune system that happens right along with us. And one of the big kind of shifts in the immune system is this decline in estrogen. So yes, in perimenopause, you get 20 to 30% higher levels of estrogen, depending on where you are in your cycle, depending on the cycle. And as estrogen is declining, all of a sudden, we're starting to see this domino effect in the immune system. So we see at a very basic level, more inflammation. So the term inflammaging, which a lot of people hate, but is a great way of expressing the aging of the immune system drives inflammation. As estrogen is declining at a very basic level, the immune system is designed to protect us. So when we talk about digestion, this is just one example, the small intestinal lining, which is where we get most of the absorption, assimilation of nutrients across that small intestinal lining, estrogen acts like, if we have a brick and mortar system to describe these tight junctions, estrogen acts as the mortar in between the bricks. So as estrogen's declining, we get more leaky gut. When we have leaky gut, food particles leak into the bloodstream and trigger an immune response. So already women will start saying more bloating, more digestive issues as a direct impact of this increase in leaky gut. leaky gut is important because with leaky gut, we get linked to autoimmune conditions. And 1,000 years ago, when I finished my training, there were probably 20 or 30 recognized autoimmune conditions. Now there are over 100. Things like long haul COVID, chronic Lyme. Once you have one autoimmune condition, you're more likely to have others. And women are 4 to 5 times more likely to experience autoimmune conditions in perimenopause and menopause. That is significant and something that's really worth mentioning. That's why I see so much Hashimoto's, celiac, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, et cetera. But that provocation of the immune system, our immune system becomes a little cranky. We start to see some other symptoms that will come up. You know, there are T helper cells, and we start to become a little bit T helper one dominant, which really represents this immunity, this kind of inflammatory process, the autoimmunity. What's interesting, if you look at the research, I don't say this to be controversial, because as soon as you say the word vaccine, people get kind of like flummoxed.
It's okay.
One of the reasons why vaccines aren't quite as effective as we get older is that we cannot launch the same immune response. And right. So I think it's important for people to understand as estrogen is declining, we are more likely to experience opportunistic infections. We're more likely to have leaky gut. The other thing that's really interesting about the immune system, and I think about something that's really helpful to understand is, I think many people understand there's this genitourinary syndrome of menopause. Super sexy. It's not a question of if, but when. We will all develop it. And as estrogen is declining in the vagina, it impacts the healthy lactobacilli. So these very important beneficial species that are there when the pH changes in the absence of estrogen being there or decline in estrogen, it drives a lot of the symptoms women experience. So painful sex, chronic urinary tract infections, more pelvic floor issues. And I think for a lot, or getting up at night to pee, also very common to see in the setting of the loss of estrogen. So estrogen acts as a helpful for the barrier, also mm-hmm. helpful for supporting the microbiome constituency, not just in the vagina, but also in the gut microbiome and elsewhere. And so I think a lot of people are surprised to know that estrogen and the immune system go together. And I'm going to give you a terrible analogy, like peanut butter and jelly. I know maybe not something that everyone loves, but I think about it in that regard, that they are so intertwined that it's helpful to understand that as your estrogen is declining in mid to late perimenopause, you're going to see more opportunistic infections. And that includes in the gut as well. And so sometimes people will say, you know, I start off the book talking about this romantic trip to Morocco and how I got sick, deathly sick, and my husband didn't. And so I didn't know at that time that this loss of estrogen was driving a lot of these changes in the immune system. So, the immune system and estrogen really are integral to together. And there's a lot more to the conversation, but that is probably one of those like more tangible ways that people can understand. This is what starts to happen. Estrogen is important for a lot of things that go on in the body. It's important for nitric oxide signaling. So even in the gut, patients will tell me, I feel like my food just doesn't digest as well, helping them understand mm-hmm. that as progesterone declines, it impacts smooth muscle contractility. And as estrogen declines, we have less nitric oxide. So a lot of people think about that in terms of endothelial function, which is still very important, but also really important for innervation in the gut. So yes, you're not imagining things. Your digestive capacity will shift, your ability to break down healthy fats because estrogen interacts with bile. So being able to break down and emulsify fats will also change. And, you know, the domino effect goes on and on and on. So, you know, I think these are probably lesser known things about estrogen. I think so much of us think about, yes, it's important for bone function. It helps, you know, with bone build up and progesterone helps with osteoclastic activity and it's meant to balance each other out. But that is like one of the lesser known. And I say this because I've now spoken on 70 plus podcasts, you know, in getting the word out about this book. And almost always when I talk about the digestive aspects of the immune system vis-a-vis estrogen loss, people are like, oh my God, I just think about it as bone. I think about it as heart. I think about it as brain. And I'm like, guys, it's so much more than that. There's no cell in the body that is not impacted by estrogen loss, progesterone loss, and testosterone loss in most women. Not every woman still has to require hormone replacement therapy for testosterone, but most, if not all, the rest of us do for both estradiol and progesterone. And I think it's important because, you know, unfortunately, there's this prevailing thought process in the health and wellness space that you just slap on an estrogen patch and everything's magically fixed. And I'm here to tell you, it is a much larger, more nuanced conversation than that.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And, you know, I was taking a couple of notes as you were speaking. And one of the things that when you were talking about the leaky gut, there are a lot of people that will say, if you have a leaky gut, you have a leaky brain.
Correct.
Which would have a link, again, which also would link the loss of estrogen to this brain fog and this lack of cognitive ability that women report, to the point where, you know, in extreme situations, you have women who actually believe that they're somehow going through early onset dementia or something, when really there's, you have this double whammy of the loss of estrogen, possible excess, kind of like neuroinflammation, because the immune system is all cranky because of things getting in that shouldn't get in, you know, these highly medical terms.
No, you're absolutely correct, Nat. I think that's an important, you know, there's a vagus, there's the vagus nerve that it innervates its bidirectional relationship between the gut and the brain. So you're absolutely correct. If you have leaky gut, you probably have leaky brain. The brain is designed to be impermeable. I actually had a guest on the podcast who said, if GABA works for you, it's
you have a leaky Scott Scher. I'll bet you it was Dr. Scott Scher.
I was like, if you have a leaky gut and, you know, GABA works for you, you probably have leaky brain. And I was like, wow. So I think it's helpful for people to know that this bidirectional relationship between the gut and the brain is really important. So if you can imagine, if your gut's inflamed, your brain's also inflamed. And I think inflammation is really at the basis for nearly all disease states, especially chronic disease states. And I think for a lot of women, you know, there's could be a million reasons why they're more inflamed on this continuum of inflammatory processes, but it's not at all surprising to know that, you know, these organ systems don't exist in vacuums. And that was kind of how I was trained, was that, you know, this is your neurology bucket and this is your cardiology bucket and here's your renal bucket. And yet we now know that there's complex interplay between all of these organ systems and the gut and the brain. And that if you are chronically stressed and not able to properly regulate your autonomic nervous system, that is going to make navigating this transition in your life 10 times harder. I mean, I say this as a card-carrying, type A, intense person, not surprisingly, former adrenaline junkie, that it made my perimenopause transition until I was able to master things, made it a whole lot harder. And it's kind of this, and I don't know if you see this with your clients, but, or the community that you interact with, but the women who are the most detail oriented, conscientious, thoughtful, I don't want to use the word obsessive because I wouldn't describe myself as that, but just like an intense person. It is hard that when you get into this transitional period that all of a sudden I'm going to say to you, do less. Not do more. Don't do more fasting. Don't do more exercise. Don't do more caloric restriction. Do less. That is completely contrary to what we have been taught and told. And that's one of those backwards things that can be very hard for women to wrap their head around. Like, wait a minute. In the past, if I calorically restricted and exercised more and just did more, it worked. And all of a sudden you realize your body's like, no, it's actually you have to do the exact opposite in order to master this middle age piece and do so in a way where you feel good.
Yeah. Well, I think it's part of it is we've been so used to muscling through things, right? We can muscle through. You muscle through childbirth, hustle, you muscle through sleep deprivation, you hustle in your job. And now, and it's not even, I know, it, I mean, definitely you have to do less, but in order to do less and not suffer terrible consequences, you have to get smarter.
Yep.
So you have to do more, you have to do less of everything, and you have to choose what's really important and prioritize the most important stuff. And that nobody wants to make those choices. Nobody wants to cut anything out. So on the metabolic side though, let's maybe touch on that a little bit, because you did a great job on the immune system, which interestingly enough is going to affect metabolism, because inflammation is a pain point to metabolic balance. But this, the metabolic transition that happens that your doctor alluded to, but many women don't even get a notice on that one. Let's maybe, which also affects the brain and the gut.
Absolutely. And I mean, I was in cardiology, so I got a bird's eye view. Like, why are all my patients in their 40s and 50s? Why are they suddenly gaining weight? Why are they suddenly telling me they're not sleeping? Why are they suddenly telling me they're really tired? And I know I've known these women for years. So number one, one of the things that starts at 40 is that we start losing muscle mass. This is called sarcopenia. And I tell people all the time, the loss of muscle mass combined with changes in estrogen levels is catastrophic. Why? Because estrogen is an insulin sensitizing hormone. This is such an important point to understand, that you can be doing exactly what you did at 35, and at 40 and 45, you can start gaining weight. It's because of a combined net effect of loss of muscle mass, unless you're working against that. It is understanding that with this loss of insulin sensitivity, all of a sudden what you ate before is not going to impact you the same way. So women will say, I notice I don't tolerate carbohydrates quite as well. So we know that, I think it's gotten out there that we need more protein as we're getting older. We need more protein for muscle protein synthesis, for leucine threshold. I don't necessarily think all the women understand that the quality of our carbohydrates becomes critically important. And we have to understand that there's a timing for carbohydrates. You know, typically I will say earlier in the day, not, you know, 9 o'clock at night, but those processed carbs are not going to agree with you. So the cookies, the candies, the breads, the pasta, all of a sudden is not going to be as hormonally advantageous. You can't quite buffer it. And so when I talk about this loss of insulin sensitivity, it's going to impact whether or not you can build muscle. It's going to impact whether or not you're able to effectively utilize either stored carbohydrates or stored fat for fuel. It's going to impact brain health, because we recognize now that dementia and a lot of neurocognitive disorders are a byproduct of a loss of insulin sensitivity in the brain. It's going to impact body composition, because we know that typically what happens in the menopausal transition is that we put less subcutaneous, the pesky fat that we all complain about that we don't love, you know, the stuff that's on the back of our arms, our hips, our thighs, that is subcutaneous fat. That is very different than visceral fat. Visceral fat is what is deposited around our main or major organs and tends to be very inflammatory. It actually secretes cytokines and other inflammatory substances that can further drive more inflammation, more inflammaging, irritate that immune system. And so when I'm thinking about metabolic health, I always use the word catastrophic so that people take it seriously. And this will continue to unwind unless you're actively working against it. So this is why we talk about macros, and we talk about meal timing, and we talk about, you know, leveraging, maintaining and building muscle. And, you know, there are lots of things that, you know, tips and tricks that I'm sure you probably talk about with your community with great regularity. But I think for a lot of women, they don't understand that you can be doing exactly what you used to do. Yeah. You know, that high intensity interval training, Orange Theory Fitness, CrossFit, doing marathons. I get hate mail when I say this, but I'm like, listen, when I say do less, it is because you will become less stress resilient, and your body cannot weather the stress that you were able to get away with in your 20s and 30s. It does not mean you are incapable. It just means your physiology is changing. And so instead of doing 6 days a week of Orange Theory Fitness with no recovery, you're probably going to do 2 or 3 days of strength training, do some zone two, get out and walk in the sunshine. That is me better served for your body composition and your physiology. The other thing that I would say is, this is why I'm a huge proponent of lifestyle measures that impact metabolic health, sleep, managing your stress, those macros that I've talked about, exercise, especially strength training, and why I'm a huge proponent of hormone replacement therapy. And certainly the research that is coming out talking about women in menopause that are on HRT plus a GLP-1. And I'm not a proponent of saying to people, you have to have a BMI of 30 or 27 with a comorbidity to qualify. I think that personalized dosing, dare I say the word microdosing, is going to be a way of the future, because there is not one patient I have that does not have an autoimmune condition or an inflammatory issue, that being on a small personalized dose of a GLP-1 is not allowing them to maintain their body composition, meaning more lean mass, less fat-free mass. Really important. You know, that's why the scale, I usually say the scale is a liar, but that's why body composition is so important at this stage of life.
Yeah.
So metabolic health for everyone listening is something all of us need to be concerned about. It's one of many reasons why I take HRT. It is why I lean into that lifestyle and why I talk to my patients about it. and why I'm also a proponent of leveraging personalized dosing. Now, notice I'm saying the word personalized dosing.
Right. Yeah.
I think that this is the wave of the future. These drugs are the most powerful drugs of my adult lifetime. As a prescriber, they're drugs that are going to change the narrative. And I think we're going to get to a point, and I hate when people say, I'm not on any prescription meds. Well, good for you, but I don't think hormones count. Number one,
any of
these GLP-1s are going to allow people to live a higher quality of life. And therefore, we can't just limit their use based on, you know, whether or not someone has a comorbidity plus they're overweight or obese.
Yeah.
I think that we have applicability to a larger population that I think is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, no, I loved you brought out the GLP-1 because I was going to bring it up myself in the sense that, you know, you talked about the digestive issues. We talk about sarcopenia, and now there's this sidebar narrative on GLPs that they're going to slow down gut motility. They're going to cause muscle loss. They're going to do all these horrible things. And I feel like I've been standing on a soapbox talking myself blue in the face, but I think that there are now so many of us in this space saying, It's in the details, people. Like if they're used properly, they literally can offset some of the most insidious parts of this journey for women. And to your point, whether it's a microdose or just a smaller dose, and even if in someone who's obese, it's your lowest effective dose that's going to give you the result that you're looking for. And whether that's just reducing inflammation or improving insulin sensitivity or whatever the case. And doing all the things, the diet, the exercise, the lifting. And so I'm with you and I'm so thrilled you brought it up because I find it a little exhausting. The negative narrative on the GLPs, the judgment, the negativity. Could we just stop being so dramatic all the time and just get down to brass tacks?
Yeah.
You know,
and I don't know about you, but generally the people that I see shaming people about using GLP-1s in whatever capacity they are generally like the gym bros who are like 25 years old. So I'm like,
yeah, so don't talk to me.
Right.
Talk
exactly. I'm like, respectfully reserve the right not to have a discussion with a man who's 25 years old. I mean, I have two adult sons. They are super lean, super metabolically healthy. They just sneeze and they're metabolically healthy. And so I'm like, there's no comparison. If I look at my husband who's, you know, 56, yes, 56, I had to think for a second. And I look at my 20-year-old and 18-year-old and I'm like, there's no comparison. Like they're just biologically at an advantage at the stage of life that they're in. And I think that there's no room for shame and blame. I think it is far more important that we are using everything that is available to be able to help patients. And to your point about side effects from GLP-1s. Okay. So let's be clear. There are definitely, I call them pill mills or weight loss clinics that are out there that are run by some responsibly and some irresponsibly. But if your provider is not concurrently saying to you, you must strength train 2 or 3 days a week and you must eat adequate amounts of protein. If they're not including that in the conversation, then they should not be prescribing it because unfortunately, even as a healthcare professional myself, I have been at events where I've had formerly obese colleagues say to me, I will never stop this drug and I'll be damned. I don't care if I've lost muscle mass. It's the first time in my adult life I don't have food noise. That is powerful. I even have colleagues who are mentioning to me that they have patients who've said, oh my gosh, I just realized I don't have any desire to drink alcohol. Oh, yes. I used to recreationally use XYZ drug. I no longer have a desire to do that. So when I say that, I think that there is applicability, especially for at least the second and third generation drugs like tirzepatide, I think that it's really exciting. And so I'm all for things that allow people to have freedom and they allow for people to have autonomy over not just body composition, but metabolic health and all the benefits that I think for a lot of individuals, maybe they didn't realize at the time, they're like, oh, I shifted body composition a little bit, but oh no, there's so many more benefits that I was even unaware of. Like the food noise piece is huge for so many patients. There's been, you know, you and I have lived long enough that we've seen so many diet fads that have come and gone, you know, volumetrics and, you know, all these, you know, gimmicks to try to trick
that HCG diet.
Yeah.
Is it HCG, the 800 calorie destroy your metabolism.
Exactly. Exactly. And I actually have licensed medical provider colleagues who swear by that, but that's a whole separate conversation. But
yeah, no, we're not going there.
I think for a lot of people, I think that the food freedom, the ability to have agency over their lives, to make better decisions, like that's beautiful. Like that to me is like, there's nothing else I can think of in my lifetime of prescribing drugs or even being a licensed medical provider that I can compare to that. I think it's really, it's a revolutionary time period in our history.
There are some good tools in longevity that are powerful, but quite impractical for daily life. Ozone therapy is one of these. The research is compelling, but most people aren't going to clinics multiple times a week or setting up equipment at home. And honestly, you shouldn't need to. That's why I was so curious when Wizard Sciences launched Oracle. It's their first ozonated oil in a capsule designed to be used daily. No machines, no appointments. Just a simple addition to a routine that's already working. What makes it so interesting is its delivery. Oracle uses an acid-protected capsule, so the ozonated oil reaches the small intestine intact. That matters because ozone doesn't work like a typical antioxidant. It acts as a signal, encouraging your body to increase its own antioxidant production, support immune balance, and improve cellular communication. And because it's delivered through the gut, you're supporting the system where immunity, detoxification, and energy regulation all begin. If you're looking for a smarter, more practical way to support resilience at the cellular level, you can learn more about Oracle at wizardsciences.com and make sure to use code NAT15 for 15% off your purchase. These issues that people are dealing with are a product of our modern society.
Yes.
It's the constant availability of food and the overwhelming availability of hyperpalatable foods that are the processed foods. So just to be clear, in a perfect world, if you're living in a world where you're only eating whole foods and you're living outside and you're doing all the things, you may not be one of those people that needs this. But if you're living in the big city and you're living the crazy lifestyle and you haven't got the best eating habits and you're doing the hyperpalatable thing and the whole nine yards, these medications come in and really start to even out the playing field. So moving on from that, I want to, you know, the book is called Menopause Gut. Let's talk about the gut as an organ. Let's kind of dive in there because we kind of got a little waylaid on the GLP-1 topic, but I think it's such an interesting topic because it's so top of mind with so many people right now. But let's get into the connect. And you mentioned it earlier about estrogen affecting the microbiome, the loss of estrogen affecting the microbiome. But let's kind of reiterate and dive into a little bit more for the audience, this whole connection between the onset of perimenopause and this transition and the gut at a systems level. And, you know, because it's going to speak to the vagus nerve again and all that kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's easiest to kind of explain what the gut microbiome is, because for a lot of people, it's totally intangible. They're like, I know what my brain is. I know where my heart is. I think I know it's somewhere in the digestive system, but not specifically. So we're talking about 40 trillion with a T, viruses, bacteria, fungi, and protozoa that encompass part of the large intestine or colon. So it's really kind of like the bottom part of our digestive system. And the thing that I found fascinating while I was writing the book is that the gut microbiome interfaces with every single organ system in the body. Like there's a gut ovarian axis, there's a gut bone axis, there's a gut brain axis, et cetera, et cetera. And what I found really interesting was that there's a lot of things we have control over. If we live long enough, we will eventually go from perimenopause into menopause. And the loss of progesterone and estrogen impacts diversity. So I just talked about those different types of microbes that are in the gut. We get a decline in the diversity, so that can drive inflammation. We start seeing more leaky gut, as I mentioned. We also see changes in something called short chain fatty acids. And I promise these are relevant. They're very important signaling molecules in our bodies. And they do things like create mucus that lines the digestive system. They help reduce inflammation. They're responsible for endogenous GLP-1 regulation along with some keystone bacteria. And some of these, including butyrate, can actually cross the blood-brain barrier. So really, really important signaling molecules. But as estrogen declines, so do these important signaling molecules. So there's a lot that changes in the microbiome as we're kind of navigating this perimenopause to menopause transition. But I remind people there's also an aspect of the microbiome called the estrobilome.
Yes.
Or as a host said the other day, it was a guy, he said the estrobilome, which Every time I say that now, it makes me chuckle. Yes, it just cracked me up. First time this gentleman had ever said it, but it's an estrogen processing center of the gut. It is impacted by the quality of foods we eat. It's impacted by chronic stress. It is impacted by the types of medications that we take. And so we ultimately want to think of detoxification. The bulk of estrogen detoxification, hormonal detoxification, occurs in our liver. So the liver is the main site. It breaks it down into water-soluble compounds. It goes to the gut. The gut is where it's supposed to be packaged up like a present, and we poop it out. That's what should happen. However, if we have a very inflammatory lifestyle, we've had a lot of antibiotics, we've used a lot of synthetic hormones, et cetera, et cetera, it can get recirculated. So the estrogen that our body's trying to break down and get rid of gets recirculated. This is significant for women because it can magnify all of those symptoms, the brain fog, the joint pain, the skin issues. It can drive a lot of inflammatory changes, weight loss resistance, breast health issues. And I think it's important for people to know that, you know, yes, you can replace hormones, and yes, that's very important, but if your gut is not optimized, you're going to still have symptoms. I will oftentimes tell women, well, women are having a lot of vasomotor symptoms, a lot of hot flashes, a lot of night sweats. I'm like, it's more than just replacing hormones. It's really looking at what is going on in the microbiome, because there's a key enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. And if it's working properly, it is helping to break down the estrogen and get rid of it. But when we measure beta-glucuronidase in stool, if it's high, we generally are thinking that there's an issue related to the estrobilome and possibly detoxification pathways in the body. And no, detoxification is not talking about a program in a box. It is actually the fact that we breathe, we sweat, we poop, we pee, all in an effort to help rid our body of things that we don't need anymore. And so I think this is sometimes a forgotten kind of thought process around aging and immunosenescence and changes in hormones, that the estrobilome and the microbiome become really, really important. Because the one thing that I've already mentioned is that we're constantly sending and relaying information all over the body. So as you can imagine, if you're not able to properly break down and detoxify, you're going to be sending inflammatory signals to the brain. So when women talk about brain fog and fatigue and mood disorders and things like that, I'm already thinking, like, what is going on at a micro level in the microbiome that's not allowing you to properly clear and assimilate some of these nutrients and byproducts and actually properly eliminate things from the body that should be there? And this is why, as unglamorous as it is, it's important to talk about the need to poop. It is not glamorous or exciting. I was interviewing an expert and I said, you know, how do you define constipation as a gastroenterologist? And she said, well, really, it's, I let the patients kind of define, does this bother me? Like, does it bother me that I don't poop every day? And I said, well, that would bother me. I generally tell my patients, you should go at least once a day, preferably twice a day. But I would acknowledge, I've had patients that tell me they poop twice a week and they think that's normal.
Well, and that's the problem, right? If you ask them to define it, we normalize everything. What we do, right? We normalize everything. So I know that what I was practicing as a nutritionist, quite often people didn't know what it felt like to poop every day.
Yeah.
You take someone who poops twice a week and you get their gut optimized and you get them moving so that they poop every day. All of a sudden they realize they've been rocking around feeling like they have a brick in their gut.
Yep.
For ages, or bloated, or they have bad skin or bad breath or all the things that, but that was just the way it is for them.
Well, their norm is normal, right? Whatever we experience, we assume that that's normal. And I think that there's a stigma about talking around these subjects. And I'm like, listen, there should be nothing.
You're gonna have to get over that.
Exactly. There should be nothing that's truly off topic, because I think there's so many hormonal changes, neurotransmitter changes, cellular changes that are occurring at a micro and macro level, that if you're not going regularly, you want to be asking, are you dehydrated? Are you chronically stressed? Like, I have people that tell me they are, well, I jokingly call it the non-public pooper. It's the person that as soon as they leave their house, they go on vacation, they can't go to the bathroom. And I'm like, all the more reason for you to de-stress, because you should be able to go to the bathroom on vacation. It should not be this like arduous issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no kidding. No, it's a thing. That's what people do. They do it all the time. Let's move over to another. Well, it's still in the microbiome, but you talk about bacterial translocation. Mm-hmm. So, how does that kind of tie into the symptoms that women are experiencing, but not necessarily connecting back to their gut.
Yeah. So when we're talking about bacterial translocation, that goes along with leaky gut. And oftentimes it's things, pathogens we're exposed to. I start the book off talking about this romantic holiday in Morocco where I got violently ill from food poisoning, where evidently there was quite a bit of endotoxin that I ingested. And that was what drove a lot of the, you know, vomiting and diarrhea and just feeling poorly. But when you get this translocation, you're actually getting leaky gut, and the endotoxin, which is generally caused from gram-negative bacteria, leaks into the bloodstream and provokes a lot of inflammatory cytokines. So it can provoke brain inflammation. It can provoke just inflammation. Like, you can get achy joints. You can have brain fog. I mean, those weren't the things that I experienced, but it just magnifies the effects of the bacteria that you ingest. So when you ingest a foodborne illness bacteria, and you're vomiting and having diarrhea, your body is trying to get rid of what does not belong, as unpleasant as it is. But at a very cellular level, when you leak endotoxin into your bloodstream, that is what provokes all these other side effects. And so if anyone listening has ever had really bad food poisoning like I've had, I can assure you that every achy body part, every single inflammatory thing, not feeling like you can't think straight, those are all a byproduct of your body trying to process and get rid of these inflammatory endotoxins. So interleukin 6 will go up, sometimes tumor necrosis factor, things that can be very noxious to our neurologic system. They can be noxious to our cells and can become, you know, problematic. So I think on a very kind of macro level, it's helping people understand that bacterial translocation is a byproduct usually of a provocation of the immune system, sometimes vis-a-vis ingestion of a parasitic friend, like I ingested Giardia, and that's what drove it. Yeah, exactly. My little friend that made me so sick.
The uninvited friend who, you know, basically caused, you know, it's interesting. I mean, when we get violently ill like that, what we forget, we feel like our body's turned on us. Actually, your body's trying to protect you.
Correct.
And that's a really interesting perspective, right? It's a real shift in perspective that, I wonder if maybe we'd get through those transitions a little easier if we didn't forget instantly, if we didn't assume that our bodies suddenly turned on us. It's
well, I think
this is a defensive mechanism. This is a, I got to keep you alive, dude. And it's going to feel ugly, but this is what has to happen right now.
Yeah, no, I think in the moment, you're probably not thinking that. You just want it to end. But after the fact, you're like, I'm grateful that my body knew that this needed to be ejected violently in order to process it. But what's interesting to me is in the setting of food poisoning, foodborne illnesses in middle age, your body doesn't weather it quite as well as it did when you were younger. So it just reaffirms why, you know, when you're traveling, you have to be careful and conscientious, which we were, but one of us got food poisoning and the other one didn't.
Yeah. Well, every once in a while, you know, I mean, I always have a kit when I'm traveling to places like that. And I'm sure you did too, but, but sometimes you, anyway, it can happen.
It can happen anywhere. Trust me.
It can happen anytime, anywhere, for sure. I have a question for you. I think in the book, you talk a little bit about how estrogen directly affects the microbial diversity and composition of the gut. I don't know that we've touched on that yet. I know we talked about how the microbiome helps in detoxifying estrogen metabolites and hopefully moving them out, assuming you have your doors of elimination open, as they used to say back in nutrition school.
Yep.
But how what is the impact of estrogen on that microbial diversity, which, again, we lose it, which is part of the problem with aging?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's research that's coming out that's comparing younger women's microbiomes to perimenopause to menopause. And what's interesting is that women in menopause and younger women, their microbiomes can resemble one another with the addition of hormone replacement therapy. So it's not yet a clinical indication. I think it will be coming. But when we use the term diversity, we're talking about beneficial bacteria, viruses, fungi. Think about it as you plant a garden, you have fruits and vegetables that you want. And as your hormones are declining, in particular estrogen, you start seeing a decline, and maybe you don't have as much tomatoes that time, and maybe you have less corn that's growing. Maybe the peas don't grow quite as much. So you have like a decline in beneficial bacteria. And what can typically happen is you will have more inflammatory species. So I've talked a lot about how inflammation plays this role throughout the microbiome and this decline in hormones. So I always use the term dysbiotic. So non-beneficial bacteria that can grow up in between the fruits and vegetables that you do want. And one of the things that's really interesting is if you look at the research, the things that impact diversity are the same things that we've been talking about throughout this conversation: chronic stress, antibiotics, ultra-processed foods, emulsifiers, yeah, additives, artificial sugars can damage the microbiome. And so it really goes without saying that, you know, diversity changes through three kind of key times in a woman's life. Number one is puberty. And let me precede that by saying, depending on whether or not you're a vaginal delivery or a C-section, breastfed or, yep, or formula fed, it imprints the microbiome. Then we go through puberty. Not surprisingly, young men and young women, their diversity changes in response to these hormones. Pregnancy is another big P. And then last is perimenopause. The irony being, by the time we get to menopause, the microbiome constituents can look very similar to men's again, but it's not advantageous for us. So it goes back to saying that estrogen plays an critically important role, progesterone to a lesser extent. And, you know, I would argue that there is some immune function benefits of testosterone, but I think for a lot of individuals, it's helping them understand that until our hormones start to decline and falter, there's a lot in the microbiome that is optimal. And then it starts, mm-hmm, to decline in response to estrogen declining. And we know estrogen kind of comes at the tail end of perimenopause. Now, if you're taking hormone replacement therapy, the thought process is that will lessen the likelihood of the impact of some of those. We don't yet have ranges like we do with bone. Like, we know for bone protection, we want your estradiol levels to be anywhere from 60 to 100 picograms per ml. I know the U.S. related numbers, I'm not sure if they're the same in Canada, but I think for a lot of individuals, I think this is the direction that research will be going, that we'll eventually get to a point where we'll say to confer protection for, leaky gut, bacterial translocation, all these other things, we'll want to maintain an estradiol level of 60 picograms per ml. Now, that could change, but I think that's the direction that I see research going in. And I ask all the microbiome experts, like, do you think it's coming? Because certainly the research that I've seen sounds very encouraging. And they said, yes, of course, there'll be lots of benefits beyond just bone, brain, and heart health. That is where I think most of the research dollars have been planted at this
point. Yeah. Well, I mean, once you get to a range for any of those systems, you're just going to want to maintain it anyway. And it's going to be the lowest one is going to be become the new threshold that you don't want to fall below. Even, yep, if the brain needs more, I mean, you might shoot higher, but you definitely don't want to go below whatever that one threshold is. So, okay. So let's talk about belly fat. Let's talk about this, you know, where's this belly fat coming from? Is it the insulin resistance, the elevated cortisol, the lack of sleep? Is there something else? I mean, you've already distinguished the visceral fat, which we don't see, which is much more harmful. Mm-hmm. But the most vexing fat, really, let's face it, is the pooch. Oh, nobody, yeah, wants the pooch. Oh, yeah. And especially if you went through most of your life without a pooch or minimal pooch, and now all of a sudden you've got this big pooch and you're like, what the heck? Well, and that, and probably it's the pooch that gets a lot of women into the doctor complaining.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, I can tell you that when my editor pitched the book title idea to me, my initial response was no, but it's a double entendre. So here it is, talking about the menopause gut and then the pooch that you alluded to. I think it's multifactorial, which is a fancy way of saying, I think it's multiple things. I think it's declines in testosterone. I think it's declines in estrogen. I think it's changes in insulin sensitivity. I think it's a loss of muscle mass. I think it is the lack of carb sensitivity. And a lot of women are still eating far too much carbohydrate for their, yeah, physiology. And by that, I mean, what is a rough estimate? I would say if you are insulin sensitive, you can probably handle about 30 grams of carbohydrate. What do I see women eating? 50, 100. And then they do that regularly, not just around workouts or recovery. And so I think that is a problem. I think the lack of sleep, because I remind women that sleep and the microbiome health are intricately interwoven. It's also interwoven in insulin sensitivity and glucose disposal. And so that's another one. But the chronic stress piece, mm-hmm, plus trauma. When I have a woman that we have looked at everything, I mean, we've done the gut test and we've looked at inflammatory markers. We've done all the work. I always go back to, what was your childhood like? You know, when we talk about adverse childhood events, which was a joint venture between the CDC and Kaiser Permanente here in the United States, anyone that's listening can get online and get access to a very short quiz. I have an ACE score of 9. That is significant. Wow. And that's so high. I remind people that in my medical training, I trained in inner city Baltimore. We talked a lot about big T trauma, rape, murder, suicide. There's no question that's traumatizing, right? And trauma is a wound, but equally corrosive and bothersome is little T trauma. You know, that's neglect, addiction, abuse, bullying. And for each one of us, it might look a little bit different. And so I think for a lot of women, they hold it together in their teens, 20s, and 30s. They've created patterns to be able to deal with their stuff because we all have stuff. None of us are perfect. And the wheels fall off the bus in perimenopause, meaning for so many of these women, I talked about the litmus test for taking care of yourself. For a lot of women in the setting of a decline in hormones, changes in neurotransmitters, all of a sudden they can't cope quite as well. And so this is a reawakening for women, whether it is getting somatic therapy, whether it's dealing with a trauma specialist, whether it's doing talk therapy, whether it's doing Reiki work, whether it's cleaning up your toxic family / spouse or significant other or job. For a lot of people, that is the missing link. I think for far too many women, I think now we're having conversations around this. It was the thing, quite honestly, Nat, that when I was writing the book, I kind of sat back and was like, whoa, like when you start looking at the research and something that I didn't mention that I think is significant, the gut ovarian axis plays a role in when you go into menopause. Guess what ages your ovaries? Lots of things. toxins, smoking, chronic stress. If you look at the research on people that experienced stress, like sexual abuse and things like that, go on to have families where their children are sexually abused. There's one research article, women will go into menopause 8 years earlier. So I think when I'm talking to women and they tell me they went into menopause at 45, 47, 48, way before the average here in the US, which is 51, I'm always thinking, what happened in your youth? Did you have a really stressful job? Like I do, I have met clinicians, GYNs, people who are up delivering babies in the middle of the night, ER doctors or working in really high acuity jobs, that will age the ovaries. And so we don't think enough about the impact of the ovaries. It's the most mitochondrial dense organ in a woman's body. And so I think we need to be really proactive about starting the conversations earlier, because I do think, I do firmly believe that that trauma piece is the missing link for a lot of women, and understanding how chronic stress impacts the microbiome, how it impacts that gut ovarian axis, how it impacts the brain. I think for a lot of women, that is the missing link, not just for the gut, but for the
everything
that many women really get frustrated with. Like I actually was talking to a girlfriend the other day and she said, I had 3 kids. Everything got all stretched out. And she's like, now I'm in menopause and I'm dealing with more issues. And I was like, yeah, it's the not so fun part that maybe more of us don't talk about enough.
But we can help. There's ways to help. Right. And I think that's what the book is all. That's part of what the book is about. The book is about building awareness, helping people to feel heard and seen. And now there's this whole rebuild, right? So if the gut is the central organ, where do we really start on rebuilding it in? And actually another question would be, do you think that if women started rebuilding their gut or taking care of their gut earlier, could it make this? Because in case somebody's listening to this and, you know, just had it on the card, not realizing it was maybe targeting older people. If you're listening to this and you're in your 20s and your 30s, if you take better care of your gut now, could it potentially make that transition easier? And then if we didn't listen to this in our 20s and 30s and we're already in the middle of the storm, what can we do to really help? Because I think one of the macros we didn't talk about was fiber. And a lot of people will say fiber will be the next macro that everybody becomes obsessed with, which frankly, I wish we would stop getting obsessed with one thing and start talking about all the things. But
Anyway, no,
back
I agree
to the
with
original
you.
Questions here.
Yeah,
when
I
we
agree
start,
with you.
We start earlier. Will that make things easier? And if we didn't, what should we be focusing on?
Yeah. So number one, absolutely. Anything that you can be doing to improve the health of your gut microbiome is going to make everything infinitely easier. And We didn't talk about fiber, but that is usually at the forefront of my conversations I've been having. And we need fiber even more in menopause and the decline of short chain fatty acids, because that is what, you know, the gut, the colon will ferment. And then from there, your body makes short chain fatty acids. So even more important in the decline of hormones. I think from a very macro level, I always say major in the majors, sleep, stress, nutrition, exercise, before just about anything else. Because if you can major, and the research is solid, like I spend a chapter on each one of those areas, everything I've talked about, there's a full chapter on. I talk about the research on the gut microbiome and sleep quality, why it's important to get at least 7 to 8 hours a night, why it's important. I hope I've made the argument, even talking about the trauma piece, stress is insidious. And most women who are not sleeping, it's because they do not manage their stress, full stop. Nutrition, protein and fiber become really important. Exercise, right amount. It's the Goldilocks effect. So when we talk about right amount of exercise, right amount of hormetic stress at the right time, it means if you do not sleep, do not go out and try to do high intensity interval training. Like, let's be smart. Yeah. I think there are far too many women who don't check in with themselves. And then they still were like, well, today's the day I'm supposed to do really my personal best on high intensity interval training. No, today's the day you go walk outside in the sunshine and do a recovery day. Yeah. So at a very kind of macro level, major in the majors, don't get caught up in buying the next gadget, which I love gadgets. I know you love gadgets, but I'm like, don't get caught up in that until you've mastered the basics. Because if you dial those in, you're going to have much greater success when you start layering in all these other aspects of what I think are critically important for perimenopause and menopause, gut microbiome effects. So don't get caught in the bright, shiny objects. Focus on the majors, get those dialed in, and then you get to have fun and play.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think you talk about four things in the book also. So there was the fiber diversity, the fermented foods, which are really important as well. I think with the fiber, one caveat maybe to mention to the audience, if we're aiming for 30 to 35 and it comes to your attention, you're consuming five, go up in increments of five, ladies. Don't just jump into 30 to 35.
I might actually say, Nat, to do, you know, figure out where you are as a baseline and go up by two or three, because it takes time for those microbes to adapt. And so if you try to go too fast, and there's a lot of awareness around fiber, and people send me free stuff all the time, just like I'm sure they do you. And I was having my husband try these fiber gummies that have been sent to me, because I was like, I won't eat those, but you can try them. And he was telling me, he was like, well, first of all, they taste good. I'm like, well, that's great. They're probably sweetened with a ton of sugar. But before you even think about adding a fiber supplement, please try to get it from some beans, vegetables, some legumes. Yeah. Right, exactly. Or like my ninja is a fresh ground tablespoon of flax and chia seeds. For whatever reason, my patients tolerate that really easily. I do it every day. It just bumps up your fiber intake. You get a little bit of plant-based protein, and it's very well tolerated versus people say to me, oh, I've got to have mycelium husk. I'm like, before you even do that, like, just try to get it from food, please. Because the bloating that patients describe to me is generally because they've gone up too quickly, too fast. And so they have to back off. In fact, we have like all these resources that we created as benefits of people that buy the book. And one of the things I was laughing about with my team, I was like, you cannot tell people to increase their fiber by 10 to 15 grams a day, they'll be mad at us. I said, it needs to start slowly. So find out where you are and increase it by 2 to 3 grams until you tolerate that, and then go up from there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course. Cool. Okay, sorry, I'm rushing you because we're coming up on time, and I have three fast, quick fire questions I want to ask you before we send people to buy the book.
Okay.
Because at this point, if they don't know that they need to read the book, they should know. So... if women understood just one thing about the connection between their gut and hormones, what do you want it to be? Just one.
I think that they need to understand the interplay between stress and their microbiome. I think that there's a lot of lip service around, like, I do 5 minutes of meditation once a week. You need to find things that you like to do and do them often. So stress management is critically important for the gut and for your hormones.
Perfect. Do you think, or would you position menopause as less of a decline and perhaps more of a recalibration that we've just misunderstood or misdescribed?
I think perimenopause and menopause is a great reframe. I think it's a litmus test. It, you know, it's a perimenopause is the litmus test, and then we get to dial it in before menopause. I'm very much a glass half full kind of person. And so when people like whine about, you know, how awful perimenopause and menopause is, I'm like, come on, ladies, like your brain hears everything that you're saying. What do you think is happening internally when you are saying that? Do I think that I got everything right in perimenopause? Absolutely not. But when I talk about it, I always say, don't do what I did. These are the lessons I had to learn. And like, quite frankly, I am so much happier. Like 10 years later, oh my God, I'm so much happier. So I think that we have to reframe it in a positive light, because you may spend not just a third, but half of your lifetime. If you go into, like, I was 48, so I was fairly young. Like, I might live half my lifetime in menopause. I don't want to reframe it as a terrible time in my life. If anything, I'm like, I found my voice. I'm like, I don't put up with anything anymore.
Love it. It's a rebirth, right? Yeah. And that was the final piece, really. Can you share with us, what does thriving, not just surviving, actually look like on the other side of this transition?
Oh, I think that number one, you're clear about what you want to do and how you want to do it. And I'm not saying that to sound like broad and nebulous, but I know how I want to spend my time. I know who I want to spend my time with. I know what I don't want to do. I have such healthy boundaries, and the value of learning to say no is so freeing without explanation. Like, no, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think for a lot of women, it's the realization that thriving for each one of us might look a little different. I think that I fully embrace my introvertedness, which I know people are always surprised to hear. Like, I like quiet. My husband and I both like quiet. We have a quiet house. We live in a very hilly part of our state where it's quiet and beautiful. And I've just been able to identify that what works for you, Nat, or someone else is totally great. Might not work for me. And I just embrace my own sense of weirdness. So part of thriving is embracing my unique attributes and not apologizing for them.
Beautiful. Cynthia, where can people find you? Where can they find your work? And where, most importantly, can they get their hands on the book?
Well, thank you, Nat. It's been such a pleasure connecting with you. Thank you again for having me. Easiest to go to my website, www.cynthiathurlow.com. At the banner on the top, you can click to order a copy of The Menopause Gut from your favorite retailer. I'm happy to report that we now have international rights for Spain, Poland, China, and Turkey we just picked up. So it's
beautiful.
An international book, which is exciting, especially, you know, we're still in pre-sale. I'm active across social media. I'm most active on Instagram, much to my team's dismay, because they're younger than me. They want me to be more active on TikTok. I do have a free Facebook group called The Midlife Pause. I know, it just doesn't resonate with me. The Midlife Pause / my name. It's a free community for men and women. There's no drama in that group. I personally answer questions, as does my lead clinician, my other advanced practice nurse that's on my team a couple days a week. And my podcast is Everyday Wellness. And I'm excited to say that we're going to grab Nat and have Nat on later this year to talk all about all the things that she's so knowledgeable about that we were talking about in the pre-chat that I need to share with my community that are super cool. So thank you again for having me.
Cynthia, thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time. I know how crazy your life is right now, so we will let you go. So excited for you for this book. Thank you.
Thanks, Nat.
Hey folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.